Just how much did a casual comment about a Premier's religion contribute to the downfall of Gough Whitlam's government?
It's a good example of how, you know, a loose tongue, especially on a touchy subject like religion, can come back to haunt you.
Hello there, Andrew West, welcoming you to the Religion and Ethics Report. We'll hear from author Roy Williams about Gough Whitlam's life as, and these were Gough's own words, a fellow traveller with Christianity. And a Palestinian peace activist talks about the challenge that Israel's occupation of the West Bank poses to that most basic need to fall in love. The Catholic Church's special synod on the family reportedly ended in a defeat for Pope Francis and his reformist allies. Proposals to relax the rules on divorced people taking communion and for an inclusive view of gay Catholics fell short of the two-thirds majority, which is supposed to represent consensus. But in the Byzantine world of Vatican politics, is this what Francis expected? Did liberals actually win a quiet victory? Our regular commentator is Thomas Rees, senior analyst at the Washington-based National Catholic Reporter. What does he think?
I don't think it was a defeat for Pope Francis. He certainly doesn't think it was a defeat. What he was trying to do was encourage an open conversation and discussion about issues facing the family. And he certainly got that at the Synod of Bishops. And it's going to continue for the whole coming year until next October 2015, when the Synod will meet again.
Well, let's talk about the two headline issues, as it were, that came out of the Synod. One was the language surrounding the Church's attitude to same-sex couples, same-sex issues. This was wound back from that, let us say, much more liberal language in the interim statement. Having spoken initially about the gifts of homosexual people, what did we end up with?
What we ended up with was coming back to more traditional language, which recognizes that the human dignity of homosexual individuals, but at the same time is not embracing any kind of sexual activity among the homosexuals. The problem that we had here was that the bishops got a little worried when the language became too welcoming or talking about positive aspects of different relationships that weren't perfect relationships according to the Catholic Church.
I do notice, however, that phrases such as intrinsically disordered, which still appear in the Catechism, they do not appear in this statement. So, in a sense, was the more liberal language of the interim statement that we discussed what you might call an ambit claim?
You know, I think what we're dealing with here is we've got some bishops who are real ideologues, who are zealous traditionalists, who really think that we've got all the answers, we don't need to change, we're not going to learn anything new here. I think that's a very small minority. But then you also have what I would call the pastoral conservatives. These are people that have grown up in conservative families, went to conservative seminaries, and followed the direction of the last two papacies. And now this pope is saying, well, let's make an adjustment here. And they're just a little nervous. They don't know what's going on. They're confused. And I think in the coming year, I think they're going to get more comfortable with this kind of change. You know, as they talk to their people, talk to their priests, consult with theologians, I think we may see some movement here.
I should also point out, though, that there was one of the leading liberals in the church, and that was the Cardinal of Westminster, Vincent Nicholls, who said that he couldn't vote for the final statement about same-sex issues because it wasn't liberal enough.
Well, that's a very interesting thing. You know, when we all looked at the language of that paragraph, we asked ourselves, were these more traditional people voting against it, or were they more liberal people voting against it, or maybe both? And they just haven't found the language yet that they're comfortable with. And I think that's what they're going to be working on in the coming year.
On the question of divorce, again, there was no resolution in favour of allowing divorced and remarried couples to take communion. But is the very fact that this is now an open question in the Catholic Church, that the debate has been cracked open, was that maybe the intention rather than getting at this point a definitive permission?
Yes, I don't think the Pope obsessed over the language of the reports. The Pope was much more interested in the process, that there be free discussion. I mean, I think he truly believes that the Holy Spirit is working here. And instead of having liberals and conservatives, you know, with this position versus that position, and we're going to have winners and losers, no, we're all going to have a conversation, and we may discover a third way that everybody can unite behind. I think that's his hope. That's his vision of how the church can go here.
Tom, you've also written one of the definitive books on the politics of the Vatican. So let's talk about the raw politics. They publish the actual results of each ballot that was taken on each statement that the church issued. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, I think it goes with the Pope's desire for transparency and for greater conversation and discussion. Now we know which areas of the document there was pretty close consensus on. We know what areas of the document there were disagreements on. Now we know what we need to talk about in the coming year. Some of these topics were just forbidden topics. They could not have been discussed in earlier papacies. The Pope has opened all this up for a more complete discussion of these issues in the church. And, you know, he doesn't see this as winners and losers or one side or the other. He didn't necessarily come in with a detailed plan, but what he did realize is the church needs to emphasize the compassion, the love of God more. You know, we have been preaching rules and regulations, and he wants a church that's more like a loving parent and less like a nagging parent.
This synod and the very open debate around it has done something that I haven't seen in many years, and that is it's flushed out the critics of the Pope. Now, people like Raymond Burke and I think Wilfred Napier, these are cardinals, powerful people, coming out almost in open revolt. Now, is this unprecedented?
I wouldn't call it open revolt. Certainly they are in disagreement with Cardinal Casper, who is presenting one approach to these issues. What we see here is a lively debate and discussion that we've never seen before in the church. And what's also, I mean, I find incredible and kind of ironic, all of these lay groups, these lobbying groups, these conservative, so-called traditional groups, that in the past used to tell the liberals and the progressives, you should be obedient to the Pope, you should think the same way the Pope does. Well, now all these people are disagreeing with the Pope and showing their true colors, that they really want their own way. They don't unambiguously follow any pope.
And is that going to pose a problem then for papal authority? Because if I can just invoke finally a Jesuit saying, which is something like, you discern, we discern, but I decide. So is Francis going to say to those conservatives, well, you've had your debate, but I'll make the final decision and you will have to live with it?
You know, this is going to be very interesting to watch. I mean, he is the Pope. On the other hand, he wants to be a collegial Pope. He wants to work together with the bishops. And I don't think he wants to make any decision until he has everybody on board. He just doesn't want to win to win. He just doesn't want to get his way in a way that might end up alienating too many people and splitting the church. No, he wants to bring us all along as a family. And his hope is that the Holy Spirit will guide us to a good conclusion.
As always, great pleasure to talk to you. Tom Rees, Senior Analyst at the National Catholic Reporter, author of Inside the Vatican, The Politics and Organization of the Catholic Church. Thanks for joining us from Washington, Tom, on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Good to be with you, Andrew.
And you are with Andrew West. Prime Minister Gough Whitlam was visiting London in 1973 when he was asked by the Labour peer Lord Chalfont about his religious beliefs. According to the Sydney Morning Herald's religion editor Alan Gill, Whitlam replied, "I'm not a Christian, but a fellow traveller with Christianity." As Australia marks the death this week of the Labour Party legend, it's time to ask what he meant by the term, and also whether a sharp exchange about religion with the then Queensland Premier may have contributed to his downfall in 1975. Roy Williams is perfectly placed to explain. He's not only the author of In God They Trust, The Religious Beliefs of Australia's Prime Ministers, but his father, Evan, was an advisor and confidant to Gough Whitlam for most of the 1970s. Earlier, I welcomed Roy Williams to the studio.
Pleasure to be here, Andrew, though a sad occasion.
It is. It is Tony Stevens who wrote The Herald and The Age's magnificent obituary, begins with that wonderful Gough quote where Gough, who was famously an agnostic, was asked, well, what if you're wrong and you did meet God? And he says, well, I'd treat him as an equal. Now, for all the humour that he injected into that comment, he wasn't really ever contemptuous of religion, was he?
No, quite the opposite, quite the opposite. He was, for a start, raised by two devout Baptist parents. Both his father and his mother were from that tradition and were very serious about it in the household. He was sent to Sunday school, accompanied there by his very stern Baptist uncle, and his sister, Frieda, went up to be quite high in the Uniting Church.
Yes, moderator of the New South Wales Synod of the Church.
Indeed, and also a missionary in later life in France. And headmistress of Presbyterian Ladies' College in Croydon. So he came from a very religious family. In one sense, he was really the odd man out in that he said he lost his faith when he was 11 or 12, probably for spurious reasons, in his words.
Mm. And, of course, he had a formidable wife in Margaret, who was a very committed Anglican. She would not have let him be contemptuous of religion, would she?
No, not at all. Margaret was a quiet Anglican in the high Anglican tradition. The thing to understand about Gough is this, Andrew. Apart from Alfred Deakin, no Prime Minister in Australian history knew more about Christianity in terms of doctrine, in terms of church history. He was absolutely steeped in it and fascinated by it all his life. He used to refer to the three books, the complete works of Shakespeare, his own massive and largely unreadable tome, The Whitlam Government, and the Bible.
Yeah. Mm. Now, you mentioned there that he grew up in a Baptist household. Now, of course, we think today of Gough as an upper-middle-class figure, rather patrician. Now, the Baptist Church, for all its many gifts, has not really been thought of as the church of the establishment. And yet, what did that Baptist upbringing give him?
Very much a sense of equality. His father was, by all accounts, an extremely admirable man. He was a Commonwealth Crown Solicitor, deeply respected on both sides of politics and a firm believer in Orthodox Christianity. But at a secular level, the value he imparted was equality. Quality of opportunity, which was Whitlam's keynote of his whole career.
Yes, he may have found, though, the Baptist theology a little strict, because I think when he was a teenager, when he had formally forsaken a belief in God, he still wanted to be confirmed as an Anglican.
That's
why,
right.
Why was that?
Well, he was going to Canberra Grammar at the time. His father, I think, had sent him there in sort of a last-ditch hope that he might be converted, and he was regarded as an insolent student at the state school where he'd been. The other great anecdote from Canberra Grammar is that towards the end of his time there, he actually received the top mark in the divinity exam, 92%. But the headmaster of the school, a canon of the Church of England, awarded the prize to the second place getter on the grounds that the boy actually believes it.
Yes, and the second place getter was himself a remarkable man, Francis James, who became editor of an Anglican newspaper and was briefly detained in China as a spy. I think Gough had to get him out, didn't he, at one point?
I think that's right. It was during his prime ministership that James was over there.
Now, interestingly, Roy, even though Gough had forsworn any belief in the divinity, when he was an Air Force officer, he actually led religious services, almost as a minister.
He did, as a sort of lay minister. He was stationed up in the Northern Territory near the Gove Air Force Base. There was a local missionary, but as I understand it from memory, he was an Aboriginal or a Fijian, and the Air Force wouldn't allow him to conduct the funeral services of servicemen. So Gough was called in. I'm not sure what his credentials were exactly, but he certainly, as I said earlier, was steeped in Christian doctrine, ceremony and tradition. And he did it very well, apparently.
Maybe his credential was that he had this appreciation of the Bible, if not as the story of a divine being, then what did he like the Bible for, its literary qualities or its historical narrative?
Well, that, but not just that. For Gough Whitlam, it was a far deeper knowledge of the place of Christianity in the whole history of Western civilization. He was completely steeped in it. Theology, church history, all denominations. He made a real point when he was member for Werriwa in the 1950s and 60s of reaching out to all the different congregations in his electorate, which in that period, of course, with the wave of post-war immigration, included Catholics from all sorts of traditions in Europe, and indeed other religions as well later on.
Now, we do need to remember that he was a pragmatic prime minister, and there were two areas of policy that really intersected with faith and public life in this country. One was his decision for Labor to adopt a position that favoured state aid to needy private, and that usually meant religious schools. Why was that so important?
The Catholic Church had been campaigning for funding for decades. Menzies sort of started the process, but the Labor Party was split three ways. You had a remnant of bigoted Protestants who didn't want a bar of state aid. The secularists were opposing it for quite different reasons, and of course the Catholic presence within the party. Whitlam realised that this debate was poisonous. It was poisonous for the Labor Party. It was utterly poisonous for the country. And ultimately the justice of the cause, that underfunded Catholic schools needed support and deserved support. And he appointed as his education shadow minister and ultimately minister Kim Beazley Sr., a very devout Anglican, by the way. And together they convinced the churches, or enough of them, that Labor could be trusted on state aid, which was a key point in the 72 victory.
Now, having used one piece of public policy to bring people of faith back to the Labor Party, you do point out that another public policy decision alienated religious voters, and that was a new Family Law Act that introduced the concept of no-fault divorce, which removed the idea that either partner had to show someone was at fault, the only reason for divorce was irreconcilable difference. Why did this annoy so many people?
The churches were very suspicious of the radicalness of the reform that the Family Law Act represented. I think there'd been a gathering consensus for years that the old fault-based system had to be reformed on both sides of politics. But looking back on it, it's hard to argue that the Family Law Act did represent a massive shift, and the divorce rate since has skyrocketed. And Christians of all denominations have made that observation. And I personally think it's a fair one. It's interesting that at the time when that went through the parliament, there was a minority on both sides of the House. Paul Keating was one on the Labor side, and John Howard was another on the Liberal side, who actually were in favour of a somewhat less radical reform that would have brought in no-fault divorce, but a longer period of separation as a prerequisite to it.
Now, just to close the loop, even though I said that Gough Whitlam was not contemptuous of religion, he did have some tense moments with the then Queensland Premier, Joe Bjelke-Petersen, who was a pretty devout conservative Lutheran. Now, he famously called Joe a Bible-bashing bastard quite late in the piece in 1975. But earlier in, I think, late 74, he had mocked Joe Bjelke-Petersen. He'd said that he was, quote, an ostentatiously religious man who has taken a vow of poverty for Queensland. Was this Whitlam really being contemptuous of Joe Bjelke-Petersen's faith? Or was there maybe a little sort of that snobbish view that, well, Joe has a more primitive fundamentalist religious position?
Well, there might have been a bit of that in the background. The fundamental problem was that Joe blocked everything within his power that Gough was trying to do. And ultimately, in the end, Bjelke-Petersen really brought about the downfall of the Whitlam government in a very practical way by appointing to replace a dead Labor senator from Queensland, a senator who would reliably vote with the coalition, a man called Field. That's the only reason why the coalition was able to block supply. Perhaps it's a good example of how, you know, a loose tongue, especially on a touchy subject like religion, can come back to haunt you.
Roy Williams, the author of In God They Trust, The Religious Beliefs of Australia's Prime Ministers, and a Whitlam family friend. And you're with Andrew West on the Religion and Ethics Report. A poll by the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs this week finds three-quarters of Jewish Israelis oppose the creation of a Palestinian state along the 1967 borders. The poll was taken following the rise of Islamic State group in Iraq and Syria and the recent Israeli offensive in Gaza. The hardening of attitudes in the Israel-Palestine conflict not only makes a two-state solution that much harder, it has practical implications for life in Gaza and the occupied territories, especially if you're a young Palestinian who falls in love. Ada Agazarian works with the Young Women's Christian Association, the YWCA of Palestine, and she's been touring Australia, and she explained how she saw the situation.
The way that this particular conflict between Hamas and the Israelis has been portrayed in the media, unfortunately, has been giving too much focus on the word Hamas versus Israel. When we think about the conflict there, we think about Gaza as a place which, despite Hamas or not, there's more than 1.6 million people living there who, in a way, are also going through collective punishment. It's probably considered the most condensed part of the world right now, with more than 1.6 million people living there, and they pretty much can't go anywhere. So the question of the money going in for reconstruction also brings in other questions as well, as to how will the people living there have access to water or electricity or economy or employment or movement. People who live there cannot get out of there. We have seen documentaries through which you see actual tunnels underneath that the people have built for certain economy purposes, for import-export purposes, or maybe for people trying to get out of Gaza. It is really, really incredible to think that out of the over 1.6 million people living there, only 200 permits are issued per month. But those permits include all of the journalists as well as the non-governmental organizations. So what this means is that there probably are a lot of students in Gaza who are applying for scholarships, fully funded scholarships to study abroad, but they can never get out of Gaza. This is the situation that we're looking at right now.
You mentioned those tunnels, though, Ada. You know that the Israeli government claims that those tunnels are used for smuggling weapons, for Hamas fighters to creep into Israel to kidnap Israeli soldiers. I mean, they're multi-purpose from what you're saying, are they? They do have a humanitarian purpose?
Yes, this is what we get, the talk about rockets being smuggled from those tunnels, and that is a possibility for sure. But the bigger possibility is that there are a lot of biscuits that are also being taken between those tunnels, and cows and cars. It's very strange to think that at this day and age, this is the situation in Gaza today, with all those people not being able to go out, and most of the world is wondering why are they so angry. I believe that Gaza, not too long ago, even if we look 10, 15, perhaps 20 years ago, it did not have any problems of unemployment or poverty, because most of the residents of Gaza, this is something that people often forget, were actually the construction workers in Israel. However, after the siege of Gaza, this of course will present a big unemployment problem and a big poverty problem as well for the people who live there, without much access to get out and without access to economy or employment.
Well, what's your narrative, Ada? Because you live in the old city in East Jerusalem. Now, for many of us who've visited Jerusalem, it's almost a magical place, that old city. But I suspect that your narrative is not necessarily one of constant joy and magic of living in the old city.
To be honest, it comes in both ways. I personally have a love and hatred relationship towards Jerusalem, because while it is a very spiritual place, people who go to Jerusalem say that they never go back as the same people that they were. It's a very spiritual, ancient place that has gone through conflict for so many years. At the same time, it is not exactly a pleasant place to be in either, because it's a very heavy place. And unfortunately, a lot of the people who do live in Jerusalem are taken by that heaviness, and a lot of them end up feeling self-righteous about the place, perhaps of the fear of losing their identity that they see in Jerusalem as well. The people there, they walk with their symbols. And the problem is perhaps that each person feels like it is their place, or they get a little bit exclusive about what it means to them, hence not give space for the other, in a sense.
We should just point out, you're of Palestinian Christian Armenian background. That's one of the most ancient of all the Christian groups in the Holy Land, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's the first Christian nation, Armenia. My family was among those Armenians who have had to go to Jerusalem as a result of the persecution of the Armenian genocide that happened in the year 1915. However, Armenians have been very much part of Jerusalem for long, long, long before that. In fact, there are documentations that prove of the presence of Armenians in Jerusalem as far back as the year 300.
You have traveled in your work for the Young Women's Christian Association all across the West Bank. Give us a picture of the daily life of living under the occupation.
When people talk about the Palestinian territories or the West Bank from an Israeli point of view, often we imagine that it is somewhere far, far away. But a place like Bethlehem, for example, is part of the West Bank and it's only a 10-minute drive away from Jerusalem. Mm. However, what this means is that while the people from Jerusalem can have access to Bethlehem, of course, there's checkpoints that you have to cross and get checked and you have to have the right sort of permits. But the people who live in the West Bank, in places like Bethlehem, Ramallah, Nablus, Jericho, and elsewhere, regardless of whether or not they're Christian or Muslim, regardless of their political affiliations, regardless of how they look at the political situation, the fact that they're there with Palestinian passports would mean that they would never be allowed to enter a place like Jerusalem or Tel Aviv or the rest of it. So what this means is that the people who live in the West Bank would not be allowed to travel through Ben Gurion Tel Aviv Airport. They wouldn't even be allowed to enter Tel Aviv. They wouldn't be allowed to enter Jerusalem unless they have a very good justification, and mostly that would be a serious medical condition of some sort.
And there are even more very personal things about the slicing and dicing of the West Bank that you point out, things that really literally go to the heart, and that is for Christians in the minority in the Holy Land, the idea of finding a spouse, falling in love with someone, can have all sorts of political implications, can't it? Because it comes down to identity papers and all the problems that might arise from that.
Absolutely. And this is something that I focus on when I talk about this situation. The truth is, when people talk about the situation in the Middle East, the Palestine-Israel conflict, everybody gets busy talking about the one-sidedness of it. You know, which side are you on? What do you think? One state, two state, and all of that. But we rarely pay attention to what does it really mean to be in such conflict areas? What does it really mean to be living inside Palestine? Because absolutely, it affects relationships. It affects basic things within the relationship. So for instance, for someone from Jerusalem who comes from a Christian background to get in a relationship with someone from, say, Bethlehem with another person from a Christian background, that relationship is going to be very, very problematic because the person in Bethlehem cannot even enter Jerusalem, much less live there. How will this relationship be affected by the political structure? It will be affected in every way in terms of where can they live? Is it legal for them to live together? What would happen to the children? Where would these children be born? Because if they're born behind the wall, different story than if it's inside. So all of these elements of life end up being part of living inside this very heavy political context.
Ada Agazarian of the YWCA of Palestine, ending this edition of the Religion and Ethics Report. Thanks to producer Scott Spark and technical producer Lila Schunner. I'm Andrew West. See you next week.
On Saturday Extra, Linda Tirado on being working poor.
And it hurts. It is frightening to people to think that the thing that we have believed about our country from the time we were in elementary school, when we pledge allegiance to our flag, we do that knowing that if we work hard and we have faith, we will succeed. To have somebody stand up and say, that is no longer true. Is frightening.
Don't miss her story. Access it via the RN website.